Welcome to Coffee Over Suicide, the dramedy podcast about mental illness and choosing life over death one cup of coffee at a time. I'm your host, Chris Parker Howard. And in a previous episode, if you're following the ongoing drama, I have been experiencing a rather unusually high level of depression and anxiety as of late. Kind of a very high level for me for the past few years. Certainly something I haven't felt in a long, long time, but I'm riding through it. Part of that update is that I did start seeing a therapist, and last minute I had to cancel an appointment due to a surprise birthday party. And that's right, I got friends. That's a brag, I guess. But then she canceled on me, and we haven't followed back up. Look, the point is, I'm taking care of things. Now, I'm going to keep this intro super, super short this week. In fact, this is the end of it, right here. This week, we're talking to Travis Moore, also known as the frontman and brainchild of the musical artist group, The Hunger Artist. That's right, The Hunger Artist. You can find out more at thehungerartist.net. And I'm going to let this conversation speak for itself. If you have not read the short story, A Hunger Artist, by Franz Kafka, do yourself a favor. Go get into it, and then come back here and listen to us get into this. So, hey, how's it going?
It's going good. How are you doing, Chris?
Doing great. I have to go right out of the gate and say I am really interested in the name of the project, The Hunger Artist.
Okay.
That the obvious place to go with that is Kafka.
Right.
So is that where you're coming from on that?
So, yeah, kind of. I mean, I read the story, The Hunger Artist. I had a girlfriend who was like a lit major.
Yeah.
She just lived by words, and she was like, you should read this. And I guess the character really resonated with me in a weird way.
Yeah.
Like, just like the whole idea of somebody so self-contained where they're just like, this is the thing that I'm going to do, and it doesn't even matter if anybody's there or not. I just thought, and at the end of the story, the dude gets replaced by a panther.
Yeah.
I'm sure you're familiar with it.
Yeah, completely.
I thought that the whole concept of like an artist just suffering for whatever the art is, like starving themselves literally just to prove, you know, it's funny because it's like, what is that guy even trying to prove? That
right.
He can like starve himself? Like,
yeah.
Good going. And at the end, he just dies and they replace him with a better exhibit. And I just think I think that a lot of artists are sort of like that too. Like certain types of archetypes of artists are just like, well, we're just going to do this and be crazy and it's not really relevant whether there's an audience or
right.
Yeah.
Well, and the other thing about it that's so interesting is that, you know, he never seems satisfied by anything that he's doing. He seems completely upset with how all of it's going, how it's being received. His own personal progress, while he's both extremely proud and extremely frustrated. And the panther is just happy to be fed.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, exactly. No, it's such a great story, and I love it. And I love just sort of it's sort of a goof in my head. Like, it's sort of like I see...
It is. That's part of the thing with Kafka. He's so ridiculous.
Yeah. And I saw the story, and I see, like, artists, just like artists, myself, even during a period of time, was sort of just like, you know, oh, I'm sacrificing, you know, myself for this thing or whatever. But the reality is, like, that's not the reality is we can model our brains any way that we want. So it's just like the acronym of the band is HA, because it's sort of like, what a funny idea that artists have to just like what a funny idea that artists are even taught by society, like,
yeah,
that they have to be there. They teach themselves. I don't really know how it works. Seems very complicated, but
yeah.
So that's, the name is sort of like, it's sort of a goof on the idea of like artists have to really suffer for their art, while also being like, but artists are like that, like sort of like a weird Venn diagram of the artist is both crazy and irrational while like not serving themselves in any way.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Completely getting in your own way.
Right. that's sort of, I mean, yeah, that's really what the name meant. Like,
yeah. That's beautiful. So is that part of your general experience in life? I mean, so just out of curiosity, like where are you from? Like, were you born in Denver or?
Yeah, I was born in Westminster, so just right outside of Denver.
Nice.
Yeah.
So you're a lifer.
Yeah. I've moved around a little bit. I mean, I lived in Battle Creek, Michigan, and that was like,
oh, nice.
It was a lot of cereal. I guess it smelled like grains all the time.
I'm familiar. I'm from Michigan.
Oh, you are? Okay, yeah. Cool. What part?
Saginaw.
Saginaw. Okay. Okay. It's, where's that at?
It's gross. It's like right around there. It's about 2 hours out of Detroit.
Cool. We were doing the hand Michigan state thing.
Yeah. Yeah, that's
people
right.
People who've been to Michigan.
Everybody knows what that is. Just pointing at my hand.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, yeah. It's right here. Yeah. So Battle Creek was cool. I mean, I moved there for a girl and it was not the best decision, but I enjoyed it out there. So,
yeah. It's an interesting place. You know, like a lot of places, the adversity can breed things in you if you're open to that.
Right.
And I know a lot of people out there who are artists and they're thriving and they're doing okay. But I also know a lot of people out there who are artists and they're, you know, just stepping on themselves at every given opportunity.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a strange situation to find yourself in. Like when the very thing that you're expecting to serve you is the very thing that's, you know, hanging around your neck.
Right. Yeah.
So you're originally from Westminster and you moved around a little bit. What were you like as a kid?
I was weird, man. You know, there's like weird things too, because I grew up like, I'm, I guess, Hispanic by social standards, but I grew up very, very assimilated, I would go with. Like, my mom loved the Beatles and Ozzy, you know.
Uh-huh.
We moved around a lot.
I think everybody likes the Beatles.
Yeah, who doesn't, right? We moved around a lot. I mean, like, she obsessed about the Beatles.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was always in new schools, so, like, I didn't have a good opportunity to really learn what socializing was, you know? And then there's the added fact of, like, I'm another, you know what I mean? So, like, there's Hispanic kids that would go to the schools, but, like, I didn't speak Spanish. Like, I'm a coconut is what they'd call me, because I'm brown on the outside and white on the inside, you know?
Yeah.
So I wouldn't fit in with those kids, and I wouldn't fit in with the other kids, because it's just like, well, you're supposed to hang out with them, buddy.
Yeah.
So, but I'd move so much that it like didn't even really make that much of a difference. Like, I'd make a friend or two, and then I'd move again, and then I'd move again. So I guess I just, you know, I ended up having kind of a lonely childhood, I'd go with. Just, I was an only kid for part of the time, and you know, I got some stepbrothers and stepsisters. My mom got married a few times. Yeah. So it's, you know, I don't know. As a kid, I was really depressed, man. And I don't know where that really came from. I mean, my upbringing was pretty traumatic. It probably had something to do with that. But I mean, I can even remember being like 5 and just thinking about like being in a coffin and just like the silence of that. And I don't know where that, you know, I literally, if it's genetics or just what it is, but yeah.
You never got a diagnosis on anything?
I did get a diagnosis. So I had a mental breakdown when I finished the song Gotta Live a Life. Like, I literally just had a mental breakdown. I don't know. There's a lot of stuff going on. And I got put on a 72-hour hold, which, you know.
Yeah.
So at any rate, they diagnosed me there with dysthymia, which is just like I'm constantly depressed.
Yeah.
But I have some bipolar tendencies. Like, I'll have periods where I'm just straight up crazy manic, and then periods where I'm just you know, you can't get me out of bed. I just am, you know, yeah. Or it's a struggle. I mean, I can get out of bed.
Well, yeah, no, I'm familiar with that. Believe me.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, that's the only diagnosis I've been given, but you know, I probably have some PTSD and other things, you know, that all amalgamate in together.
All the way back from 5 years old.
I mean, there's some really, really weird stuff going on. My first stepdad was pretty abusive, so he liked to beat me up and say rude things.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. And he's a pretty big dude, man. So it was like, and I don't, being a kid, maybe he, you know, was pulling back, but, you know, I'd be bruised up and down. It was crazy shit.
Huh. You
know? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's not, was he a drinker?
No, he wasn't actually. He was a pothead, which is, he was a pothead drummer, man. Like, I don't know.
That's insane.
It is insane. And like, I don't necessarily hold any hard feelings because he, you know, back in the day, he'd be like, this is how I was raised. So this is how I'm raising you. And
right.
I mean, and on the one hand, it's like, yeah, sure. But on the other hand, it's like, dude, grow up. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah. I think that some of that with a lot of people, I mean, and again, I'm just projecting off of the two things that I know about this guy. Just the very idea of, you know, trying to go backward and do the math on what would make somebody do that to a kid. The first thing that comes into my mind now as an adult with hindsight and, you know, other various tools that I've picked up here and there.
Yeah.
Is just the idea of a person who felt like they were also incredibly unhappy as a child. You know, sometimes adults, especially if he was sensitive enough to be a musician, there's, chances are good that something happened to him.
Right.
And he was trying to beat it out of you before it manifested.
That's, you know, I believe that.
Yeah. But that's of course a terrible thing. Like you can't do that to someone. Not only does it not work, but it's just wrong.
Yeah, it sort of takes like a high level of just narcissist projection to be like, this little human being, if I don't do the right thing by them, by beating the pulp out of them, then they're going to end up screwing something up or whatever. And it's literally that. It's projecting yourself onto somebody else and then deciding, furthermore, that it's best to punch yourself. Or what, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
punch
exactly.
That thing that you're no longer treating as its own subject, but as an object that you can, yeah.
Right. But I mean, if you take those things and you put them together, it's really difficult to say which thing came first.
Totally.
You know, the chicken of getting the shit beat out of you, or the egg of just being born that way.
Right.
Like, how do you really know? And after a certain point, does it matter?
Right, yeah. I hate the whole nature versus nurture stuff, too, because it's like, sort of, at a certain point, it doesn't matter. At a certain
right.
point, it becomes just like, that's the human being. And
yeah.
Their nature or their nurture is irrelevant because there are people who, yeah, I mean, we all know the nature versus nurture, blah, blah, blah thing. But at the end of the day, you end up with the person and the nature and the nurture aren't really relevant.
See, I feel like there is an element in human beings where you've got a moment of freedom as a person who's fucked up. You have a moment of freedom in that, and that moment ends the moment you have the self-realization that you're fucked up. Because once you recognize that, you have a responsibility to do something about it.
Right.
You can't just say, that's how I am, I hope the world is ready to deal with it.
Right.
Because then you're horrible.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, and nobody wants to be around somebody like that.
Yeah.
So, picking up those pieces of yourself and carrying them forward, do you think that that had anything to do with needing somewhere to put yourself, i.e. getting into music? When did you start playing?
Well, so that's also kind of interesting because I've always been into music. Like, I was 5 years old and I joined the choir in kindergarten. They had me sing a solo, and I remember it being really traumatic because I came down with like a bad cold. Like so bad that they had to throw me in a tub full of ice water, just the fever to break the fever. And I sang the solo anyway. It was like 2 weeks later and my voice still was gone. And so like, it was just like, oh man, you know, but yeah, I mean, I've been into music since, I mean, as far back as I can remember. I really like to write, and that was sort of really what got me started playing guitar was I would write poems and they were just garbage, but I just really loved writing. It was just like, oh man, I got to get all these, whatever they are, out, you know?
Yeah.
And I realized after writing enough poems that nobody really cares that much about poems that they can't dance to. So I was like, oh, I'll learn the guitar and, you know,
yeah,
put some melody to it. And that's sort of really where, I mean, I started writing songs and figuring all that out.
How old were you when you got your first guitar?
I was 12.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a great age.
I asked for it. I was playing the clarinet in band. Like, I've always been in music.
Oh, awesome.
Funny side story. I actually got in band because it gave me an extra 30 minutes for lunch at school. And one of my friends played the clarinet. He was like, dude, you get an extra 30 minutes. I was like, really? What instrument do you play? He says, clarinet. Cool. Can you teach it to me? And that was, yeah. And then I played clarinet. But yeah, I picked up the guitar and I didn't pick it up as heavily then because things were pretty weird at the time. My parents had picked up drug addiction, so yeah, it was good news. Worked out really well for them, I think. No, I'm kidding. It did not. So
those stories always have asterisks.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. They picked up a drug habit and life worked out really well.
Right. Asterisk.
No, but so, yeah, I didn't get lessons or anything. I just sort of self-taught, fumbling my way through it, kind of combining what I learned in band class with, you know, how a guitar works. And eventually I figured it out.
What were you like on a clarinet? Like, did you learn how to read the music or were you, like, you know, able to sort of fake it?
I could read the music. Yeah, I could do the treble clef. I would have a hard time now because it's just been so long.
Sure.
Maybe. But yeah, I could read the treble clef.
I think that would translate, though. I mean, just to be able to have musical language.
Yeah.
Like, I'm a drummer by trade, but I can pick up most instruments and figure them out enough
right
to fumble through something. Like, and I think that most musicians have that capability.
Yeah.
But I think that musicians who start with instruments where they learn how to actually read music, they do have a leg up on a lot of people.
Yeah, I think that helped me a lot. I mean, it basically opened the door for me to start reading books about music theory later in life, where I was like starting to get really more interested in songwriting and just like how to make things sound the way I want them to sound, I guess. And it very much helped out, like, oh, okay, this is how I get to a minor chord. This is how do I get an augmented fifth. Oh, all I do is add an extra note, you know? Sort of like the idea that there's only 12 tones, and it's like, okay, so how do I arrange them to paint a picture? And having that initial language helped me build a better foundation, I think, for sure.
Was that something that you were able to use as a tool to help you deal with the depression?
Oh, yeah. I mean, music for the longest time was my only escape from the depression. It was literally the thing that gave me solace just ever. So
I mean, that's the way that I think most people are when they're a musician with depression. It's such a perfect box to put all of that in, because when you're done with it, you have a box,
right? Yeah.
You have this beautiful thing that you can show people and say, look at this thing I went through.
Right.
And now it's art.
Right. Yeah. It's like, I went through terrible things and then they went through my filter and they came out pretty.
Right. Exactly. And they're horrific and they're sad. And yet they bring me joy.
Right.
And I think that that's a thing that's difficult for some people to wrap their head around, is the idea of sadness bringing you happiness.
Right. Yeah.
But I mean, it certainly can be done. I mean, I had Will on here, and he was talking about, you know, that's why there's the blues.
Right.
It's the same thing. It's an expression of something bad to make you feel better.
Right.
I think that's fair. There's not a lot of other things that you can see that in life. You know, not a lot of other negative options where you can turn that negative in your life into a positive other than creating some kind of art.
Yeah, I mean, that's I think the most beautiful thing about art or just creating things in general. I mean, I think the definition of art can sometimes be a little bit too rigid because, sure, you know, even, you know, Starbucks, you know, in its own way is a work of art. You know, somebody took their experiences in life. And so, yeah, I mean, it's art in all of its forms is so beautiful, and just people taking their whatever it is, all their experiences, and putting them in whatever box. It's not just even like the catharsis for the own person. It's like, you know, that ability to give somebody else some sort of respite from whatever it is. You know, I know growing up when I would listen to music, and you know, I had a particular, I liked depressing, you know, lyrically focused stuff. And when I'd listen to it, you know, I'd listen to what the person was saying and I'd relate to them. And to me, it would just be like, that would lift the whole, like, oh, I'm so alone in the world. Nobody understands me. I'm like this weird alien wandering the surface of the earth. And then I put on these headphones. I'm like, oh, there's this other weird alien who kind of gets it. Or like, we're vibing on the same wavelength and we're completely states miles apart. You know, it's just, I think that to me, I mean, that's why I make music. Is or why I release it, you know, a lot of me is always reluctant to release music because it's sort of like once you put all those thoughts down on record, that becomes like who you are to other people, you know what I mean? And I, as a writer, I'm super reluctant to put out anything that would leave an it's easy to be misunderstood, and I think any writer worth their salt goes into writing anything knowing that first and foremost. So since it's super easy to be misunderstood, like, I'm super reluctant to put anything out there because what if somebody misunderstands what I'm saying and just like totally takes it the wrong way, or they, you know, hate me without even knowing me because I, you know, said, you know, it's just bizarre. So, I kind of got off on a tangent there, but the most really, like, the whole reason why I make art is just to give somebody who might be another weird alien out there, like, maybe they'll come across the track, maybe they won't. But if they do and it resonates, that's really cool.
But you can't always manage the expectations of other people.
No.
And you certainly can't go through life worrying about the intention of your art.
Right.
Because once you start having the battle of intention versus reception, you're never going to release anything.
Right. No, absolutely. Yeah. That's been a long running. And one of the big reasons why it's a long running concern for me is like a lot of the things that I write, I tend to write when I'm depressed or like feeling bad about something. And those are the thoughts that end up getting recorded. And I have this weird sort of nagging feeling in the back of my brain that like, if what I record is just all my negative thoughts or like bad, just not negative, that's maybe the wrong way to characterize it, but just not the most positive thoughts, then I'm sort of, I'm just trapped in that forever, you know? And so it's been a long, long struggle for me being like, okay, well, I've got loads and loads of material. I've written a whole first album and I'm always just like, I wrote the first album when I was in a really dark period of time. And it was just sort of like, I was approaching actual true nihilism, which is just sort of just like, I don't know that that's like, I don't believe when people are like, oh, I'm a nihilist. Like, no, you're not. Because if you were, you would not exist. Like, you would literally just stop existing. So I was approaching true, like, oh, I'm just going to stop existing. And I wrote that album during that time. And it's like called hashtag whatever, because it's just like, well, whatever. I'm throwing up my hands at the world.
Yeah.
But then putting that idea out there, it's sort of like, well, you know, I don't – first of all, I felt that way because things were going bad, you know, and my – frame of mind, I'm always growing as a person. I'm always changing, you know, and I think about artists like Trent Reznor, or like, you know, he put out The Downward Spiral and literally went into a downward spiral after that, you know, and it's sort of like, you know, was that art imitating life? Was that life imitating art? Or did he fuck himself up by playing those songs so many times that it disturbed his brain? You know, it's hard to, so like going and putting out those songs on a record, going out and playing them, like they're hard songs for me to play sometimes. Like they're just bummers. And there's one song that I stopped playing live because like people wouldn't clap afterwards. They'd be staring and like listening to every word and they'd just stare in dead silence. Like, oh my God, you just bummed me out. Like, And but so like, you know, is that the image that I want to leave behind?
Right.
Is sort of like, I have also, like, I think of artists like Elliott Smith, and everyone's like, oh, he was such a bummer all the time. Or Kurt Cobain. Oh,
yeah.
Or, like, you know, people are like, oh, such a sad boy. And then you read interviews and stuff, and his friends are like, man, they had a great sense of humor and was always laughing. And, but, like, that impression is what's lasting, you know? And
well, that's because people want to feel like they know where to put you based on a snapshot of some ideas that you had once.
Right.
And that's ultimately what, you know, your records are going to be. They're going to be a snapshot that reminds you of not even necessarily a person that you were in any given moment of time, because you can have ideas that you don't believe. You can have ideas that you want to explore that you don't like.
Right.
And people are complicated. They're incredibly complicated. And to think that you can water any individual down to a single photograph in an ocean of millions is crazy.
Right.
But yet we do that with people. We want to know that, you know, our rappers are real gangsters, that, you know, that Kurt Cobain was sad and the only way to control it was through more sadness. Like, that's what people want. They say they want that authenticity, but the reality of that is they don't want authenticity. They want simplicity.
Right.
Because authenticity is hard. Simplicity is easy.
Right.
That's the whole nature of the argument.
Yeah, they want that whole surface essence.
Yes.
Drain the rest out. Just give me that distilled surface bit.
Yeah, exactly. And so when you start putting your music together, when did you write your first songs? Around, like, you got your guitar at 13 and you're plunking around.
Yeah, I mean, I'd always been writing songs. They were very, very bad. To start with, I mean, I didn't even know how to play a chord. I mean, so you got to think, I came from band, and in band I'm playing single notes on the clarinet. So I literally just took that over to guitar and I'd just be playing single notes. I had no, you know, I didn't even know if I was writing riffs or not. Like, I just had no education, no ability to really figure it out. And, like, the internet was still sort of in its infancy-ish.
Sure.
So yeah. They were there, but I started writing songs pretty much right away. I'd just take the lyrics that I'd written and add them to notes, and they were very, 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 rudimentary, I guess would be the best way to put it.
So how long was it before you had enough material that you were like, I can't wait to show this to other people?
So that's a interesting question, because I've never really wanted, like, I so there's both the drive to show it to other people, and like I was saying earlier, like, I have this also drive to not do that,
right.
And so I feel a little bit paradoxical, like, on the one hand I'm like, oh, look at all this stuff I'm doing and that I did, and then on the other end I'm like, but don't at all. So I don't know, I've always been writing songs. I had actually signed on with a publishing company like 6 years ago under a different band name, and I got weirded out. Like, they were inviting me down to do A&R stuff, and, you know, I just, like, oh yeah, you have to have this particular image on this particular page and yada yada this, and I just was like, man, and I just dropped out of music for a bit, because it's not what you were looking to do it for. Yeah, that's that whole, you know, we want the surface image distilled. And you know, they were trying to make me a political band because I had written some political songs at the time. And it's like, you know, at the time I was stopping even like caring about politics even. So just like, you're going to make me do this particular image at this time. And I'm like, you know, I'm just washing my hands of the whole, like, yeah.
Politics is so personal that it seems, blasphemous to have someone say, I think we can sell this.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, it was
as
weird.
As much as you might want to do something like that organically, the moment someone says, you know, I think we can put this on a bumper sticker, of course that's going to give you some serious pause.
Yeah.
Like, whoa, that's not what any of this is. I mean, like, don't get me wrong. I'm perfectly happy to sell art.
Right.
Absolutely. Let's make a living off of our art all day long.
Yeah.
But the moment you want to take something that matters to me and pervert it?
Right.
Not interested.
Yeah, totally. I'm taking my ball and going home.
Yeah, like, exactly.
cool story, guys. You know?
Yeah.
Glad that's your message.
Thanks. Thanks for the story where you are the punchline later.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, no, it reminds me of like so the band System of a Down. I was reading through The Westward or something a couple of years ago, and they were playing at Comfort Dental Amphitheater. And I was like, System of a Down? I mean, I understand the nature of the beast, and I'm not dissing on them or anything, but it's just funny. It's just funny.
Yeah, it is. It's funny.
Yeah.
It's absolutely funny. I mean, anytime I see, you know, giant conglomerate park, I mean, it's really bizarre, especially like so I just went to a punk rock festival at Fiddler's Green. But it wasn't lost on me, you know, the number of $5 waters and, you know, $50 t-shirts and shit like that. Like it was, it was omnipresent.
Right.
It was unavoidable. The people with the VIP passes were the people who were like the least punk rock people I've ever seen in my life. And it was really such a strange dichotomy because they obviously wanted to be there.
Right.
The music obviously spoke to them in some way, but when Dickwad Brad in his in his polo shirt with his flip-flops and his like rapey dude bros show up at the bar and they're like their conversation is unavoidably terrifying. It's like, what the hell are we doing here?
Yeah, yeah.
It was weird.
Yeah.
I admit it was weird.
Yeah, and it's so I'm very much a homebody. Like, I don't like leaving the house, mainly because of, like, things like that. Like, I mean, it's just, like, I never know what kind of experience I'm going to have.
Yeah.
And sometimes, like, I mean, I love people. People are the best. I have great conversations with people all the time. But, you know, there's that social anxiety. Like, oh, man, what if I just run into the wrong asshole?
100%.
One wrong asshole could literally ruin my life.
Yeah.
You know? And so, like, man, I get to work from home. I'm blessed in that way. You know, I have all my stuff. So it's just like, you know, my friends come by. I don't leave the house. I have two or three places that I like bicycling to. The rest of the world I'm staying out of because there's too many Brad rapey douche bros out there
who
might think I'm a hijab from, you know, Muslim, the Middle East or something and, you know, target me for some sort of weird crime. You know,
yeah.
I don't know.
And you can overthink all of that all the time. And why give yourself the hassle of doing that when it's so much nicer to just stay where everything is good and everybody likes you? And even if everybody doesn't like you, including yourself at any given moment, you're pretty sure they're not going to kick your ass.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. we'll have a strongly worded conversation, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. We're going to sit here and be sad and eat ice cream and watch Netflix by all alone. Like, we'll do that. I'll punish myself that way.
Right.
But, you know, I think that in my own experience, I was also a kid that got bullied as a kid. It moved like well into my late teen years because in my area, I was a weirdo. And so I think that I developed a social anxiety out of that.
Right.
Because there's the recognition that violence could come from anywhere for reasons that don't make sense.
Right.
Reasons that completely defy logic. And so when you're talking about, yeah, I don't know if I want to go to a place necessarily where there's a chance for something like that. It's like some of that is calculated.
Yeah.
I mean, you've been around enough things and enough people to know roughly, you know, almost like the when you're living in a bad neighborhood, the good block, bad block.
Yeah.
You know, I can walk down the street here, but I can't walk down the street here. Not so much that you can't, but there are risks.
Right.
And you know that you've calculated those risks based on experience thus far. But you start taking those experiences from the back, from the front end of your life. And you're just extrapolating, and you start making new things out of those old issues.
Right.
And so the idea of, I don't know if I want to go there because maybe there's going to be some violence. While some of that might be true, some of it is manufactured.
Right.
But how do you tell the difference when they both feel the same?
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. It's crazy, you know. I mean, and I've had, you know, I've had altercations, all sorts of different altercations, you know. I mean, my band has played some really, really shady dive bars. There is one in particular off of like Federal and Jewel. I don't think it exists anymore, but this very, very drunk guy, there's like barely even a stage. He just like put his arm around me and started trying to like play my guitar. And, you know, it turned out like 2 days later, somebody was stabbed there. And I wasn't super nice to the guy. Like, I was like, dude, get away from me. Like, you know, and like looking back in retrospect, like, dude, somebody was like, what if that was the guy who stabbed somebody? I don't even know, you know? Anyway, yeah, it's just.
Right. If I told him to remove his arm.
Yeah.
He would have and got his knife.
Yeah. Well, I did tell him that and he was fine. I was like, dude, what are you doing? Come on, man. I'm drunk. I'm like, okay, cool.
Great. Again, that's a person who is making an excuse for a decision.
Right.
Instead of taking ownership over a decision.
Right. Yeah.
But of course, you know, when you're drunk, you're not really thinking in those terms. You know, am I taking ownership of this inebriation?
Yeah.
I really owning it?
I mean, once you're drunk, you have to be owning it because, you know, what else are you going to be doing? You can't go back in time on that one.
No, not at all. I mean, you can drink all the water and coffee you want, but the only thing you can do is ride it out.
Yeah.
It's very similar to depression and anxiety and things like that in that sense.
Yeah.
Because it's almost like a complete hijack of the way you're feeling. The difference is most of the time I'd rather not be inebriated.
Right.
Because I don't like the feeling of being out of sorts and having to ride it out.
Yeah.
You know, but the kicker on that too is that when the depression hits, of course I want to drink.
Right.
And create a cycle.
Yep.
For myself.
Yeah, it's interesting how that works out. And it's so funny that like the thing that, I mean, I love drinking, you know.
Yeah.
And,
well, we're in Colorado. It's a good city to do it in.
It very much is. And my drummer friend, Stefan, he brews beer and stuff. And so, you know, but like, yeah, I think it's funny that the thing, you know, when you're depressed, like the first thing that you, not the first thing, but a lot of people choose to go to a depressant. And it's like,
yeah,
I mean, I understand, you know, you're numbing the feeling and you're just sort of trying to forget. And I think it's funny because, you know, people say that you can't travel through time.
Yeah,
I think you can. You can travel forward in time with alcohol.
Yes, exactly.
And so, like a lot of the time, people are drinking to forget their problems and move forward in time. Just like get past that day, get past that day. I'm bored. I want to get past this day. And then, but what ends up happening if you're like depressed? You're depressed because you know stuff's not right. Something in your brain, and then that leads to all these cycles. Or okay, I didn't do the laundry this week. Oh, now my kitchen's a mess. Now my house is a mess. Oh my God, I'm so terrible. I'm so terrible. Now I'm just going to stay in bed all day. Now you know it gets into this cycle.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. Yeah. Just and then the first thing, you know, let's have a depressant.
Yes.
And
there are things I'm not dealing with. Now let me go get something that will let me not deal with them some more, but be okay with that.
Exactly. Let me just erase the fact that I'm not doing anything today and then tomorrow. Yeah. And, yeah, exactly.
Let's make this tomorrow my problem.
Yeah. It's like, I don't know. Have you seen the series BoJack Horseman at all?
Yeah.
That is such a great depiction of mental health and like just the struggles. And I love it.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean that constant the way that character is constantly trying to bridge the gap between what he knows about himself,
right,
and what he wishes he could do,
right,
is a sad portrait.
It very much is. It is like one of the saddest. It's like, I don't know. I've heard people like, oh, I relate wholeheartedly to BoJack Horseman. I'm like, are you really sure that
want
to say that? Yeah. Like, yeah. And I'm sorry. Like that guy is, you know.
And what are you
that
doing
horse man?
That?
Yeah, exactly. Like, could you fix that? Because I think the whole show is about him trying to fix that sort of.
Yeah,
sort of. Failing miserably at pretending that he's trying to fix it.
It's just shy of too honest.
It is. Yeah.
Because we all go through something like that. You know, the people who have mental unwellness issues, it's it's a process that doesn't go away. It's not something you can fix. It's
right.
just something that you got to figure out how to handle, because it's not leaving.
Right.
Until you leave.
So I like to think of it as like neurosynaptic highways. And like once you start that cycle of the cycle of depression starts from chemical imbalances or traumatic things or who knows, you know, it's varied bag.
Wiring, all kinds of stuff.
But once it starts, you get that cave, there's sort of tunneling a stream in your brain. And then you add the other things on there, like, okay, well, now I have to drink to numb this. And you add that alcohol to that same neurosynaptic pathway or whatever drug it happens to be, you know. People take it to super extremes and just shoot up heroin and, you know, lose their lives, you know.
Yeah.
And it's tragic. And it's like mental health is like the number one cause of, you know, most addiction. I would argue all addiction.
I would argue that as well.
And it's so funny to me – well, not funny. It's really sad that society treats, you know, mental health in such a shitty way. Like I was on that 72-hour hold I was telling you about earlier after finishing the Gotta Live a Life song. And I couldn't afford to pay for it.
Yeah.
3-4 years later, they started garnishing my wages for me being on a mental health hold. I was financially solvent at the time and I had figured my stuff out, but
right.
if I wasn't, that could have sent me into a really terrible cycle.
That could
you
have
know?
Killed you.
It literally could have killed me. And that was the state's decision to send it off to a collection agency and have them garnish my wages. That was literally the state's approach to mental health. And
right.
that's embarrassing. It's absolutely embarrassing.
It is. Because I mean, these are people who need help.
Right.
You were a person who needed help.
Right.
It's not like you were there, you know, getting your teeth whitened, you know?
Yeah, it wasn't a convenience thing.
Yeah, absolutely. So when you went on that hold, what did that teach you?
Well,
like in that time period, like because you're sitting there, I imagine you've got some time to think.
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah. So, I mean, did you learn anything in that time period?
You know, I kind of hate to say it, and I don't want to sound crass or anything. I don't know if crass is the right word, but what I did learn was that I didn't belong there.
Yeah.
At the psychiatric place that they put me in. It was a pretty nice one, but like just the people that were there really had some wiring broken.
Yes.
Really, really badly. And I was just like having an existential crisis for a moment. And so just talking to some of the other people there who were some of them fundamentally out of their minds.
Yeah.
It sort of put me in a place where it's like, I don't need to be here. I should leave. And I left and they gave me a prescription for Zoloft, which I took for a month and hated. So I got off it. But
yeah. Zoloft is hard.
Yeah.
Zoloft is harsh.
I didn't enjoy it. And I mostly self-medicate, which people could, you know, it is what it is. I've never met a therapist that really like got me. And I think like just all the stuff that I have that's just baggage and adversity or whatever, like it could be hard, I think, for certain. I just have to find the right person.
Yeah.
And that's a whole nother project for me, man. You know,
yeah.
I mean, I'm doing like 3-4 projects right now. You know,
well, there's layers.
Yeah.
Honestly, the way that I come at this subject, I'm sure is completely wrong from a textbook standpoint. I'm 100% positive of that because what I'm about to say to you goes against everything
right.
that anyone would ever teach you. And what I would say is if you are aware of yourself, enough to be able to take care of yourself to the point where you're fed, you're clothed, your bills are paid.
Right.
And you're not going to kill yourself. That's enough.
Right.
Right there is enough. Everything else, however you're getting there, however you're managing it, as long as you're not really hurting yourself or really hurting other people.
Right.
That's great.
Yeah.
You've figured out what works for you. Because there's no magic bullet for any of this.
Right.
At all. That's actually a really bad turn of phrase to use.
I didn't even think of that.
I guess there's a regular bullet for it, but that's But that's the wrong option.
Yeah, totally. So it's weird because, like, for a long time, I talked earlier about just, like, the stepdad dude. Yeah. And he was, like, really beat up my self-confidence. And
yeah.
For a long time, I was really suicidal because of that. And I don't think I realized that, you know? It's like it came to a point where it's just like, dude, I just don't love myself.
Yeah.
And like by me not loving myself, I'm hurting people that love me. Like even if I'm not doing – like even if I'm not being harmful to them, like just the fact that I exist and don't love myself, the people that love me, I'm hurting them.
Yeah.
You know, regardless of anything else that I could be doing. Like it makes them sad to see that I'm not – because if you don't love yourself, you're automatically hurting yourself. I mean
– yeah.
So anyway, I got to a point where I just sort of traced that back and was like, you know, and I have to say that gave me a lot, was just realizing that I didn't love myself and, you know, owning that and just, oh yeah, yeah cool.
Yeah. I think that using the damage, that you've undergone, because I mean, you've gone through and you've made some repairs. You know, you recognize there's a short in this wire. It's only through active intention that I'm going to do anything about this, because there's no other way for this to get resolved. I could take medication, not a road I'm comfortable with. I could go see a therapist. It's not working for me so far. So if I got to live with me, how am I going to handle that?
Right.
And so if you figured that out, nobody can really tell you that that's wrong, because ultimately, at the end of the day, you're with you.
Right.
And you know whether or not you're going to live through you.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's important. It's important to come to that place where you can recognize where you're getting it right and where you're getting it wrong, and also where you need help when your own fixing isn't working. But if your fixing is working, more or less,
right,
you're probably good for now.
Yeah. Yeah. Keep trucking, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. So you go through all of these things, and you start putting some music together. You find some other individuals who also want to make music. And now you've got yourself in a place where you're not just musically creative, but I mean, you're a pretty creative person just in general. I mean, you know, with the photography and the digital manipulation of images and things like that, it seems like that's something that you put everything into.
Yeah, I've just always been creative. I don't know, you know, how to quantify it or anything. I don't know. I think a lot of my perspectives probably, or a lot of my experiences gave me a little bit of a, well, they definitely gave me a warped perspective.
Yeah.
And so it's just sort of like, I can't help but see the world from a lot of different viewpoints. And sometimes I just can't help but like put it out there, you know, just, I'm bored. I'm going to put together a weird Photoshop image, or, you know, I'm going to take a weird photo, or, you know, I just, yeah, it's like, I don't know. I feel like, generally, there's not a lot of thought that's being put into culture right now. And I find that to be kind of a bummer, you know? Yeah. Like, with everything going digitized, you lose on album art, you lose on lyric sheets, you lose on just so much stuff that, like you could really see who an artist was back in the day and really relate to them more than you can now. Now it's just like, oh, I've got my tracks up on Spotify and hopefully one of them's a single, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Which, you know, won't happen for me, but go Drake. but like, you know, and it's just so, it's sad to me. And that's, I guess I can't help but put the extra, I don't know if it's the extra effort. It's just like, I get an idea in my head and I'm just like, well, why don't I just make this, you know? Like,
it's what's necessary for you to feel like it's completed.
Yeah. Yeah, I had an idea about a Kanye West plunger like a year and a half ago, and I finally figured out how to put that together. And we made like 12 of them and sold, you know, all of them except for three. And
yeah,
and I've got, you know, I gave a couple away to some friends, and it's just like, you know, I don't know, why not? If you have it bums me out because so many ideas I feel like people have and then they just don't do them. And it's just sort of like, yeah, it's consuming and it's hard and it can be annoying and maybe it doesn't come to fruition, it all falls apart, but at least try, Yeah. You know, just try. Absolutely. Put something weird and new into the world. There's not, in my opinion, even with the internet, there isn't enough weird stuff in the world. I mean, nobody else had thought of a Kanye West plunger with Kanye West's face on it. There's a billion things that just could exist right now. And
they should.
They should, yeah. And I feel like people just spend too much time, you know, embracing their technology, their little cybernetic arms and, just wasting valuable creative potential. And overall, it's just, yeah. So, I mean, I like being creative in that. And it's just, overall for me, it's just like, why not? You know,
yeah.
Like, what else am I doing? There's right. one life to live, and why not have fun?
And after you've spent, a year on something. You know, you look back on 2018, when 2019 rolls around, you'll have things you can point at and say, this was my year.
Right.
These are the things that exist in the world that did not exist before I put them there. Here they are.
Yeah.
You know, like Zeus with clay statues in the Colosseum, you are placing them down and they are now in the world. And long after you're gone, there they are. Out in the world, which is kind of great. There's going to be a Kanye West plunger in the world after you die.
That's probably true, yes.
How great is that, though? I mean, look at it this way. You are a human being who has had some horrific experiences that other human beings have not had. And that did a couple of things for you. One thing was trauma. The other thing was it gave you another color to paint with,
right,
that other people don't normally see. And so, of course, your point of view is skewed because you have more colors in your palette than a lot of other people.
Yeah.
So you're going to see more things when you're looking. Other people have the ability to see it too. They just haven't.
I want to add to that, though, because what's interesting about that palette and what I've learned over time is that sometimes there are colors that are on that palette that shouldn't be there. Like,
yeah,
there are times where my trauma has colored experiences such that, like, you know, I've stepped over, like, the story of the hunger. I've stepped over my own foot, you know,
yes,
just by, oh, and, you know, so I think part of dealing with trauma and having that extra color, and one of the things that I would say prevents a lot of people who are probably very creative and very able to do similar things to anybody who's a creative, is just like they forget or they don't realize that they have to remove those extra colors, those
yeah,
really dark ones that they're adding, you know, or whatever color you want to choose
yeah,
to call them, you know,
no, absolutely,
the toxic, murky ones that ruin
exactly
interpersonal
like,
relationships,
you know, sexual assault, abuse, things like that. They can definitely cause problems. It's, you know, it's not to say that there's a value
right,
in every one of the colors on your wheel. There just isn't.
Right.
There are some that they're just going to make things worse.
Right.
But the main point of what I was trying to say with that wasn't necessarily that, like, now you have something valuable that other people don't have. In some of the cases, yes. But in other cases, it's like, here's this negative thing that sort of seeped into this other thing. And the negative thing isn't valuable. It's hurtful. It's damaged me. There's scar tissue in my psyche or however you choose to interpret that. But it's left a mark that's not good. It's not a positive. That said, I think that there are times when something can be a catalyst for something else, whether it's tragically awful or not. There can be times when something really awful happens to you and it's a catalyst for something better.
Right.
Which isn't to say the great thing wouldn't have happened anyway, or that, well, see, I taught you a lesson by knocking your bell around. Like,
right.
Like it's not always worth that,
right,
but you know, it's not always making lemonade out of lemons.
Yeah.
Because sometimes you can't.
Yeah.
But it does color your perceptions on the universe, and it does infect the overall picture of who you are as a human being.
Right.
And it's you, not the event, but you and what you've done with yourself, not because of, but in spite of.
Right.
Is where that beauty comes from.
Yeah. So I find that really interesting, too, because I have a personal struggle a little bit from time to time with just the whole, the adversity made me who I am. And I've done a lot of cool stuff that, you know, I dropped out of high school and started a mortgage company with a friend. Like, my life's just insane, you know?
Yeah.
And I wouldn't have done that without all the adversity. Probably. Maybe I would have. Who knows? But it's sort of like, it's sort of like a double-edged sword where, like, on the one hand, like, oh, man, all this bad stuff. It's so terrible. Wah, wah, wah. But then on the other hand, like, I wouldn't be who I am without all those experiences. So, yeah, I totally get what you're saying. It's right. Weird. It's a weird sort of like, okay.
Because how do you reconcile those things? Because they're disparate ideas.
Right.
It's a complete clusterfuck of you know, madness, sadness, and beauty.
Right.
Like, all wrapped together in a human being, like most people are. But, you know, there are certain things that probably be better if it didn't happen to you.
Right, yeah. Yeah, totally. Yeah, and if those things didn't happen, would I be who I am? Who knows? You know, it's sort of like, maybe best not to think about, you know? I've learned that it's best not to think about.
It probably is, but at the same time, you never know. You really never know what your life would have been, but again, it comes right back to that mindfulness of, it doesn't matter after a certain point.
Right.
It's, what are you going to do now? The world is this, your past is this, and now who are you going to show up as today?
Exactly. Yeah, I agree completely with that. Yeah.
So what's next on the horizon for the for whatever the hell you're doing next?
I mean, so first of all, I don't know whatever the hell I'm doing next, but I mean, I've set up a recording studio in my basement now, and we're working through the next three tracks from my first album. So we're trying to get that out by the end of the fall, which in my head is December 21st, because
right,
that's when fall officially ends. And other people said, you know, they might have different ideas. But yeah, I mean, I've had the tracks recorded for so long, it's just pretty persnickety about how things should sound. I mean, you know, I recorded at the Blasting Room and stuff like that, because it's just like, I learned a lot from that experience, by the way. It was pretty amazing just watching somebody like Jason work. Yeah.
Yeah, but, the legendary Jason Livermore.
Yeah, absolutely. That guy is – he just the way he moves in the studio, it's amazing. Well,
that studio is an extension of him. He's been there for so long.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It's that had to have been an intense experience.
Yeah, but yeah, so we're working on recording three more songs for our next EP, and then we've got the first album's a 9-track album. I've had it done for a while, I've had the demos done for a while, and now it's just a matter of like, okay, let's really solidify. One of the big things is getting my drummer to actually record drum parts. It can be sort of pulling teeth sometimes, or I don't know if pulling teeth is the right word, but and I write MIDI drum parts, and they're just like, you know, basic bass, drum, snare. And he can actually play the drums, so it's generally better when somebody can play the drums comes in. But basically, I guess what I'm working on is getting him in to record drum parts. And then, yeah, we're shooting to release hashtag dumb sometime this fall. Yeah.
Well, that's awesome. And
yeah.
It sounds like you've figured out an algorithm for yourself to be able to take care of yourself and live with yourself.
Oh yeah, I mean absolutely. It was trying, and I think mostly it's just like, you know, if you hear a lot of negative stuff about yourself when you're a tiny person, it ends up being the thing that you carry with you, and eventually, you know, you just gotta it's you know, break down that stupid father figure. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you know, there's father figures everywhere. Our society is run by, you know, father figures, and they're doing really stupid shit. So
yeah,
it's just sort of like remembering that, like, well, that authority had no authority really. You know, the emperor had no clothes in that instance with that particular first stepfather. And you know, and I learned that basically growing up, I learned that adults don't know what the hell they're doing. And I think that was a good lesson.
Yeah. Well, and especially now that you're an adult and you recognize that you don't know what you're doing.
Yeah, exactly. I'm making my way through. Yeah.
Well, I'm glad you're making it through.
Yeah. You too, Chris. I mean, yeah.
Thanks for talking to me.
Yeah, thanks for having this podcast. It was great.
How do you fit so much chill and so much intensity into one human being? That guy was really fun to talk to. I really like sitting across from him, and we talked a whole hell of a lot off mic. But you know what? That's just for me. Sorry, I can't give you everything. As much as I'd like to, where would you put it? That's it for me this week, everybody. I'm going to try and work out all of these issues I'm having with my therapist. You know, I just don't know if that's what I need right now. I need something. I don't know what it is. But the important thing is, I'm on the lookout to try and make myself better all the time. And I'm just going to keep doing that. Be sure to check out thehungerartist.net to get yourself some music. And until next week, don't kill yourselves out there.